to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Chris Nagy, executive editor for Bloomberg, in for Mike Regan, who is vacationing, and we have no further information on his whereabouts.
Mike's enjoying himself. We'll leave him out of the episode, but thankfully, Chris is here with us to take his place. This week on the show, though, second quarter earnings season has officially started. We'll walk through how it's shaping up so far. And the Trump administration keeps mentioning the idea of dollar devaluation. Could the U.S. actually intervene, and what would that look like? And of course, we'll close out the episode with our very own tradition, the craziest thing I ever saw in markets this week. But thankfully, we have some great guests to join us this week. First, we have Evan Brown. He is the head of multi-asset strategy at UBS Asset Management. And he was also an associate at the New York Federal Reserve back in 06 to 09. So that means you're going to tell us exactly what's going to happen on July 31st, right?
That's right. I know. I can read Jay Powell's mind.
Absolutely.
No problem.
Yeah, no problem at all. And then we also have Lynanne Nguyen, thankfully. She covers finance and Wall Street for Bloomberg News. So she's here in a very busy week that she had.
That's right. And in my past life, I was a markets geek, too.
So she can play in on everything dollar devaluation as well. Evan, I do want to start with you. I know we are not very far along in the earnings season at all. Very early days. But we came into it very low bar. From what we've seen so far, what can we actually take away from it?
So we've mainly seen earnings come out for the banks. And I actually think the news on that front, talking about the big banks focused on the consumer businesses, it's been reasonably good. Seeing consumer loan growth, business loan growth, the economy generally looks decent. And the guidance has been decent. So, like you said, it is early days, but a low bar, and right now earnings are coming in okay.
Bloomberg has a story up right now saying that banks, undoubtedly the hugest Wall Street banks, they mean, are having their worst quarter in some, like a decade or something for trading. Is that meaningful to anyone but a bunch of insanely rich New Yorkers?
Well, it's not, I think it's more a comment of the challenging environment for markets and the lack of volatility and the lack of trends that we're seeing across markets. Just people are not trading that much, and conviction is low, especially when you have the trade tensions and the like. So that's more of a specific comment on how the markets have been as opposed to how the economy
is. Why is that true, though? The markets, I've noticed, are doing rather well this year, up to 20%. We're like halfway through the year. What's the problem?
Yeah, it's just it's too easy. No, when every asset goes up and there's not a lot of differentiation and you're not getting kind of also the same kind of conviction, like just as much as markets are going up, we're seeing outflows from investors, and a lot of what's being driven is corporate buybacks and the like. And so the client flow that you would see on these trading desks has just not been that active.
Lynanne, come in here, because I know you've been in very early every single day this week ahead of each of the big bank earning releases.
Yes, I have.
What? You sound so happy about that. What have been the big standouts, whether that is a company or a certain trend, whatever that may be?
So Evan summed it up, but it's basically Main Street good, trading bad. So we've seen that the big Main Street banks, the ones that have a big presence on the consumer side of the market, have done really well. The Bank of America, the bank that I cover, reached record profits for 5 quarters in a row. So generally, banks that have a big consumer-facing business are doing extremely well. The question is when that's going to turn around, when the guidance is going to roll over. We did hear some warnings about that this week throughout the consumer banks. So JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citi. But for the time being, they're doing pretty well.
One area that has been a little bit softer has been net interest income, net interest margins. JB Diamond came out and basically described it as blowing in the wind. You can't know
blowing
which way it's
wind.
Going to go.
That's right. Well, it's blowing against them right now.
Right, right. So when you actually look at this unit, this entry into the bank's balance sheets. How big of an example, how big of an effect has it actually been?
It's their main revenue driver. So it's very, very important. And Jamie Dimon is kind of diminishing its importance, but at the same time, it's a key input people are looking at. And again, we're going to have to bring it all back to Jay Powell, because if rates are cut on July 31st, then that's going to really squeeze those margins for banks. So they're watching that very closely. And analysts ask them about this multiple times on every call this week. So it's a huge focus.
Well, how does the whole calculus work? I mean, I get that the profitability of the loans goes down. Doesn't the volume go up potentially, or at least is sustained because the lower rates keep the economy flowing?
Potentially. And they did make this point as well, which is that, you know, even if they're squeezed on one side, potentially activity in the economy goes up elsewhere. But I think generally it's not seen as a good thing.
Interest rates are the input here. And that brings us to the Fed. Over at UBS, Evan, what is your guys' take on what's going to happen at the end of the month? Are we going to get a 25 basis point cut, 50 basis points, or nothing at all?
I think we will get a cut. That seems quite clear after last week's Jay Powell's testimony, where he essentially focused on every potential negative thing and downplayed anything positive going on in the economy. And so he wants to cut. There will be a cut. So as you say, the question is between 25 basis points and 50 basis points. And to be honest, we're really not sure at this point. It seems that there are arguments for doing 50 basis points. If you are concerned about the economy, why not do it in one go and kind of shock the market and try to steepen the yield curve? That's something that is being discussed at the Fed and in markets in general. On the other hand, you do have other members of the Fed who don't think there's a case for a rate cut at all. We're hearing from a few names, Kaplan and Bostich and a few of the regional Fed presidents. And so it's going to have to be a consensus building exercise. And usually the chair is able to get their way. But it is notable that you do have people who just don't even think a cut is necessary on the Fed right now.
I can sort of see where they're coming from. I mean, you can easily form arguments on both sides of the argument. One thing that somebody mentioned to me today, I don't even know how legitimate this is, but his point was that what they want to avoid ultimately is not a recession. They want to avoid seeming like they were Ben Bernanke, like they were sort of fiddling as the economy fell into a hole, and only 6 months later did anyone realize. Does that have any resonance?
I think that certainly this is a risk management cut, right? It's a tremendous uncertainty we know about trade tensions, and so they acknowledge that maybe the economy doesn't look so bad right now, but just in case, let's err on the side of being a little easier and. We can do that because inflation is relatively low.
John Williams, New York Fed president, he kind of made his voice known this week as well. He put out a speech on Thursday, and it was called Living Life Near the Zero Lower Bound. And my inbox had been flooded with analysts and commentary basically saying that now John Williams is setting the stage for a rate cut. This is huge because he has a lot of influence on the board as well. Lynann, coming back to you, if we get a 50 basis point rate cut, or even 25, say, is that actually good or bad for the banks? I've heard some people make the case, all right, you have lower interest rates, that's bad for the banks. But at the same time, theoretically, you could see the yield curve steepen, because on the short end, you'll have rates go down. And then on the long end, you could potentially, hopefully, see inflation pick up a bit.
I think generally it's being read as a bad thing for banks. But again, these implications are lumpy. A lot of the banks on the earnings calls this week did mention, okay, if we get an X basis point cut, this is how much it will affect our revenue. So from a pure numbers perspective, that is a downside. However, the banks were also talking about the fact that clients have been on the sidelines. We heard sidelines like a million times this week because people are unsure about the interest rate environment. They're unsure about how much the Fed is going to cut, if at all. And so they've been waiting for that certainty. So perhaps when certainty comes and when the Fed makes it more clear what they're going to do, clients will start to reposition their portfolios, and we might see some of that activity that's been waiting on the sidelines come back into the game.
is things like credit quality and stuff like that, is that a factor for banks at all at this point, or are they just rock solid?
It's just rock solid. It's pristine. It's wonderful right now. No one has said anything bad about credit quality this week. In fact, Bank of America actually made fewer provisions for loan losses this quarter. So right now, it's looking pretty good.
Another thing that could potentially give cover for more rate cuts.
Well, you love to hear pristine then when it comes to credit quality from Lanann. Evan, I know over at UBS, you guys brought down your recommendation, brought down your rating on U.S. equities to neutral. What's really the reasoning behind this? Is it just the fact that we've seen such a crazy gain already this year and you might as well wait and see what happens?
So we took our exposure to equities down mainly because we just think a lot of the good news is in the price. We've seen, it's not so much that we've had such a great year of equities, it's that the year in equities has all been driven by multiple expansion as opposed to expectations of earnings rising. And so a lot of that is based on a more dovish Fed. And we think that's in large part priced in at this point. And we think that, the global environment is still a little bit murky. We came out of the G20 and there was euphoria out of the G20 that we didn't get fresh tariffs. But when you look around, not much has changed. I mean, maybe there's a ceasefire, but there doesn't seem to be at this point clear signs of dialogue or any kind of movement towards any kind of deal at this point. And so I think there's some downside risk to business investment still China, Europe, some of the data is a little bit murky. So in general, equities, we've taken down a little bit, having been overweight for most of this year.
It's true that we're up a ton in 2019. I saw someone else saying a couple of days ago that if you sort of annualize it over the last 2 years, it's not that huge a market. We're basically about where we were, well, maybe a little few percentage points above where we were at the beginning of 2018. Isn't that strange given that we just had the biggest tax cut in the history of America? I mean, you would think that earnings would have driven something a little bit more significant than that by now.
So it's a great question. I think what the point is that the tax cut, which took effect in 2018, really got priced into markets in 2017, such that you come into the start of 2018 and it's basically priced in at that point. And then President Trump starts the trade wars, right? Yep. And so ever since the trade war started, we've basically been flat in the S&P, maybe a little bit higher, but that gives some context.
It's interesting what the turn of the year does to people's opinion of the market. Everyone's walking around like we're having this gigantic year, but I mean, we're not that far above where we began in the beginning of fourth quarter. So
you go from one government policy, though, the tax plan, to another, and that is potentially currency manipulation at this point. President Trump tweeted earlier this month about Europe and China, how they have been manipulating their currency and saying that the U.S. should match it. And Evan, I know you've been looking a lot into this. Is this even possible? If the U.S. were to come in and manipulate the dollar, what would that actually look like?
Well, manipulate is a strong word.
I mean, yes,
it is.
I think someone else's words, but I just used them.
the president can authorize the Treasury to intervene in foreign exchange markets. Mm-hmm. It's the Treasury Department that does own foreign exchange policy. And if you add up dollar liquidity, SDRs, which can be converted into dollars, and then foreign exchange reserves that can be swapped into dollars, it's about $95 billion worth of ammo they have to intervene in foreign exchange markets. And then the Fed actually has the same amount. And traditionally, on its own balance sheet, the SOMA balance sheet, traditionally, the Treasury and the Fed have acted in concert to intervene. The big question right now is, well, if the Treasury does decide to intervene, will the Fed necessarily follow? Because typically, to justify intervention, it's based on disorderly markets, and it's hard to argue that FX is disorderly at this point. In fact, it's barely moving.
So calm. Everyone's complaining about how calm it actually is. So if somehow the Treasury Department did decide that they were going to move on this, and in a hypothetical scenario, in a hypothetical world, the Fed said, okay, we'll match it, does this pose any risks? I mean, what would be the fallout from this?
I do think markets would initially be unsettled. You know, we've had a long time, about 25 years of a strong dollar policy, or at least a laissez-faire dollar policy. And then all of a sudden that's changing, and that will shake markets a bit. I do think that once the dust settles, you know, maybe a slightly weaker dollar, it's going to be good for U.S. equities. It's going to be good for emerging markets, and you go from there. What I think would be really interesting, and something we're talking about, is if there's not just intervention, which there's more or less $200 billion of ammo, which is decent, but not huge, given the size of foreign exchange markets, $5 trillion exchanged during a given day. But if the Treasury starts moving in a direction of a strategic recalibration of its reserves, if they say, hey, we've only got $40 billion worth of foreign exchange reserves, and Europe has $350 billion, and Japan has over $1 trillion, we should have more foreign exchange reserves. We're going to make that argument. It's only fair. It's only it makes sense to modernize our foreign exchange portfolio. And that sends a very powerful signal to the market that that the Treasury is looking to weaken the dollar over the medium term.
Is this something that you actually take into account, the idea that this could be possible going forwards when you try to come up with a target for the dollar and other currencies?
I think what you have to do is probability weight it. Mm-hmm. So is it our base case that there's going to be intervention? No. We think ultimately probably Secretary Mnuchin and others are successful in advising the president not to move in that direction. But I would say there's, given that President Trump has been tweeting about this, given that there was a report that he had actually tasked aides to look into how to weaken the dollar, we have to take it seriously. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a 25%, 30% risk of it happening. And so we have to embed that into our views and weigh that when we consider going long dollars in an FX portfolio.
Bloomberg has had some reports out saying that behind the scenes, when President Trump has been interviewing potential Fed candidates, that he's been asking them about what they think about the dollar as well. So that's pretty interesting. But even besides, you put manipulation, that strong word, aside, intervention aside, is the path of least resistance still down for the dollar? It seems like people have been talking about that for a while, but now we're in this holding pattern.
Yes, we think so. We think it's not just based on potential intervention. It's based on the U.S. economy catching down to the rest of the world, right? Remember, we had that big fiscal stimulus, which is really rolling off as we speak right now. And the rest of the world is hanging in, U.S. economy decelerating, Fed cutting. Over time, that should lead to a weaker dollar.
But you guys are positive on European equities, correct?
We like European equities. We think there's just too much negativity on Europe.
You're the only person I've heard who is actually
really
bullish on European stocks.
Yeah, I mean, anything you read about Europe, it's always very negative about the economy and the outlook. And I don't mean to downplay, there's plenty of structural and political issues that always seem to come up in Europe. But when you look at the economic data, it's just not that bad. You know, the consumer has held in well. You would have expected investment to take a much bigger hit given the trade tensions. But investment has held up well, too. So we think a lot of the bad news is in the price, and the European economy is actually in reasonably good shape, and we can see some outperformance there.
They should be benefiting from some stimulus, one would argue. It seems like they actually pull that off fairly well over there at the moment.
Yeah, so we've got likely some monetary stimulus coming from the ECB, and we have a little bit of fiscal stimulus happening in Europe, at least not fiscal restraint, you know, for the first time in a while. Italy, France expanding fiscal, and even Germany doing a little bit here. So there is some policy support there in Europe as well.
With that said, Chris, you know what time it is, though, in the podcast.
I believe I do.
You
but
do.
Remind me what we call it.
The craziest thing I ever saw in markets this week.
Oh,
so
right.
Excited.
Yes.
Taking Mike always brings it. So I really hope that you're going to step up to match
I wasn't told I would have to bring anything. No, but okay. go on.
Like we said, every week we reach out on Twitter. We ask around, see what people are noticing. So I'll start with a couple of the things that we have seen out in the Twitter sphere. I'll say this isn't breaking the rules. Bloomberg's own Dave Wilson, he's a stock market columnist, a very frequent person who appears on radio, on TV. He tweeted it and he said, maybe I'm not eligible, but I said, there's no rules here. It's the craziest thing I ever saw in markets this week. So he said, trucking stocks rise one day because J.B. Hunt's results go over well. And then railroad shares decline the next day because CSX's figures are disappointing. That's some contrast.
What's a Dow theorist supposed to do when that happens?
Right, what are you supposed to do?
Normally such a license to print money, Dow theory.
Evan, when it comes to you guys, how you guys actually go about evaluating the economy, how much do you guys actually take into account earnings reports from some of these big transport names?
We definitely look at them and we look at the, certainly look at the guidance. And you know, one thing in particular that we like to do is we're using natural language processing to dive into the qualitative comments of all these earnings reports. And so we can really detect and see how the language is shifting. And that in many ways can be actually more useful because it's more forward looking than the backward looking earnings report. So it's a little bit early for us to make strong judgments right now on that. But that's what we'll be doing over the course of this earnings season.
Whoa.
All right, Linan, I think you're up.
So initially, I was going to talk about the dollar and the prospects of dollar intervention, but we have covered that. That is actually something crazy that started last August with the note by Michael Feroli from J.P. Morgan, and it made a big splash at the time because everyone thought this is crazy town. It's now part of the mainstream lexicon and part of people's thinking. Obviously, Evan's looking into it and everyone is thinking about it. So that's wild. But secondly, because we've already discussed that, I wanted to raise a report that our colleague Natasha Doff in London wrote about, which was intelligent dictators are more attractive to foreign investors.
Oh, interesting. Why?
So this is a report that basically says that dictators or authoritarian rulers who are well-educated, who maybe worked in business, are viewed favorably by investors, I guess because they'll kind of keep things on an even keel.
Things are calm.
Yeah.
People are happy.
Yeah, which we've seen in markets. Sometimes there are people in certain regimes, you know, maybe Evan can cite some, who are, you know, maybe you don't agree with them in terms of their politics, but because they have a strong hand, it keeps the nation fairly stable and means that you can invest there.
Who knew?
Maybe it's just if you come across well on TV, it almost doesn't matter how unbelievably evil you are at this point.
How unbelievably evil you are. All right, Chris, you got anything?
So this isn't that weird, but there was a story in a rival publication pointing out that right now the S&P is a couple percentage points away from doubling from its high of the last bull market. So that's October of 2007. So in other words, if you bought stocks at absolutely the worst time you could pick with hindsight over the last 20 years, you're now up about 9% annualized. So it's kind of a stock journalist's geek out because this is what happens at virtually any longer horizon that you get to about 9% eventually. When you even it all out, except for one period, which is this is really interesting. If you bought at the top of the internet bubble, if you made the mistake of buying in March of 2000, your annualized gain is 5% at this point. It's like one of the big anomalies of that entire series going back 100 years that long of a period would have that poor return. And just as we've discussed endlessly, or I have basically forced everyone to discuss on our team.
Markets go up.
Yeah, markets go up constantly, but the dot-com bubble is really the big artifact of the stock market over the last half century.
Excuse everything.
Yeah.
Evan, I think that means it's your turn.
So the craziest thing that I've seen this week, Thursday morning, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin coming in and saying that the dollar policy of the United States is not going to be changed as of now. He did not have to say that. And he said even that's something we could consider in the future. All things that did not need to be said, but he went ahead and said them. And words matter. And central bankers, sovereign wealth funds around the world that are using the dollar as the main store of value and reserve currency, listening to that, that's really, really stunning. And I do think there has to be some risk premium placed in the dollar given that U.S. dollar policy may be changed.
You and Lynn Ann are really on the same wavelength here.
We're currency geeks, what can I say?
What can you say?
No, but it was really, it is stunning. I think that's something that really was very, very, very much of an outside chance. And even when I was reporting on it last summer, everyone was like, this is crazy, but now we're actually having to look at it. And now everyone is looking at it. So it's a really spectacular change.
See what happens in the next 6 months, year, who knows? So, Evan, you and Lynn Ann are clearly having a connection here. Well, I had a connection with a Twitter follower of the podcast this week, and he tweeted, his handle is JDScottyDY. He said, in a word, Neuralink. Do you guys know what this is? So, it's one of Elon Musk's startups.
Oh, right.
He is very heavily invested in it. And this company, Neuralink, they're now saying that they are able to do brain surgery, and they're approaching the FDA to see if they can go in and get approval to do surgery on human beings as soon as next year. Now, what they do and what they are hoping to do in the future is they drill these really, really tiny holes in your skull, four holes, and then they put these extremely small wires that they call threads into your brain that have electrodes. And the idea is that they're supposed to emit these neurons so that you can communicate with the computer without actually having to say anything. All you have to do is think. So you can think, all right, I want to send this text message. I want to send this email, and it will go. And they hope that in the future, maybe telepathy will be a thing. You can read other people's thoughts, and you can also download languages into your brain, and on and on and on.
Could we read cats' thoughts?
It's pretty crazy.
Cats?
Yeah.
Well, right now, supposedly, they've been doing this on rats.
Oh, my God.
And there were rumors that they were doing it on primates, and supposedly Elon Musk came out and said, yeah, I'm addressing the quote-unquote monkey in the room. There's
apparently,
a monkey that's communicated with the computer.
This does refresh my memory, and apparently it's like the same way that you would mount a flat panel TV to a wall is the way you're describing it, to stick wires into the brain, I guess.
Sounds like the same thing.
Yeah. What could go wrong?
Pretty easy.
Although I would happily volunteer for it at this point, the way my life's been going lately.
You can go into the clinical trial next year if they get approval. if they do, that would be pretty crazy, but I had never heard something like that. So there we go. With that said, though, Evan Brown, Lynn Ann Nguyen, thank you so much for coming on. And Chris Nagy, thanks so much for stepping in to fill Mike's shoes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reaganonymous. Chris Nagy is at ChrisNagy1. And Lynn Ann Nguyen is at Lynn Ann T. Nguyen. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.